That's true. You're being so far.
It's been early, but we can go ahead and start if you want to start.
Sure. We've got people standing in the back. There are a few seats up here if any of you who are standing would like to come up.
Yeah.
No one wants to get that close to us. I don't blame you. It's been
all
really
right.
Hot.
Well, we'll try to dispel your fears of us over the course of our introductions.
Like you, answer the question.
A bunch of strange folks in black.
Yeah.
So I'm Kit Walsh. I'm a staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, not to be confused with Dragon Con's EFF, Electronic Frontiers Forum. And I will introduce myself and talk about my relation with car hacking and the law after our other panelists, TJ and Jeff, introduce themselves. And why don't you also just say a little bit about your knowledge or experience in relation to the topic of this panel, which is hacking vehicles.
My name is TJ Myhill. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta, Georgia. I work with copyright and have spoken on the DMCA many, many times. So my experience hinges mainly around the DMCA. I do drive a car, but that's about the extent of my technical knowledge on this front. But I'm very, very familiar with the DMCA and the DRM issues that have come out of that.
Hey, my name is Jeff Termeshuizen. I've got degrees in political science, cybersecurity, and MIS. I'm currently working as a technical consultant for a company called ACI Worldwide. They are a financial payments company, and I help do their security and install systems for them. And on the cybersecurity side, the overlap between cars and the SCADA systems, so the industrial control systems, are fast overlapping. The cars tend to be more ahead of it because they're newer. But there's quite a bit of overlap there between the industrial control systems and the kind of technologies we find in cars and the same sort of loopholes we find in cars.
Great.
All right. Apparently we're not allowed to move those things, so.
All right. So I
just. All right, there we go.
For anyone who's not familiar with EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, we are a nonprofit digital civil liberties organization. So we do a wide range of work around privacy, free speech, freedom to tinker, right to repair, anywhere that the evolution of technology might interfere with liberties, we are there to make sure that the right legal regimes are observed and to put pressure on companies to give greater respect to their users' privacy and speech rights. In the context of vehicle hacking, vehicles are just one example of devices that are now computerized, where, as a strange side effect of copyright law, which maybe TJ could talk about a little bit, some of the manufacturers are claiming that you do not have the right to open up the devices that you buy to see what the code is, to modify it. Actually, TJ, do you want to talk a little bit about just the DMCA and how it might relate to cars?
Sure. Well, the DMCA stands for the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And the Digital Millennium Copyright Act exists because people were trying to shoehorn a law from the 1970s into the internet and other technology advances. And it tried to cover a variety of different things. It covers everything from websites to boat hull designs. But it's there to try to make what was a very advanced law in 1976 apply to anything relevant today. One of the things that came out of it was applications over people's digital rights management. In other words, there were things that companies were doing to try to protect the software or electronics or other copyrighted elements that they were sending out to the public. Because we've sent them out there now, they're things that you can access. How do we keep people from accessing them? How do we keep people from copying them? How do we limit piracy of CDs or DVDs or things like that? The real issue that has come around this is something that is decades old. It's the idea that we can now license instead of selling things. Because copyright is very, very clear that once I sell you something, it's yours. You can do whatever you want with that copy. You can't photocopy it and make 100 more and give it away, but you can sell your copy. You can trade your copy. You can give your copy to your friend to read. That's something that's perfectly legitimate, because once it's yours, it's yours. The problem that was arising is when people were sending out software or sending out easily copyable discs, it was much easier to copy. You don't have to worry about standing there with a 1,000-page book at the photocopier to give your friend a copy anymore. You burn a disc and you hand it away. So it was something that was trying to address that. The digital rights management laws were trying to address that. But what manufacturers did was they said, that shit's not working. What do we do over here? And they came up with this idea that we're not selling you your software. We're not selling you your electronic maintenance devices. We're licensing the rights for you to use them. And so you don't have any right to transfer it. You can't take your copy of Windows and sell it to someone else because you don't own that copy. And the courts have upheld that. The courts have upheld that idea that this license is a license and not a sale. It depends on how your ownership works. There's a lot of fact questions that go around it, but there is a way that I can give you something you can't sell, you can't use, you can't copy, and you can't access legally. That's what we're dealing with here in the cars. I sold you a car, but you don't have ownership of the electronic elements in that car. You don't have ownership of the software, the various chips, and the various controls that run that car. So what if you want to go in and access those? What if you want to change some of the limiters? What if you want to change your brake points? What if you want to change your shift points and make your car a little faster? What if you want to change your exhaust? Can't do that because you don't own those codes. I've licensed them to you, and they're subject to digital rights management under the DMCA.
So the auto manufacturer's position is sort of what TJ just described. So they assert that you do not own the code in your car. They assert that you do not have the right to circumvent the access controls on that code. So there are two issues here. One is the licensing issue that TJ just described. And the other is part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that was intended to keep people from doing things like breaking encryption on DVDs with entertainment products on them, says you're not allowed to circumvent a technology that controls access to a copyrighted work. If you're thinking about DVDs, that sort of seems like a reasonable way to phrase that. But the copyrighted works is really, really broad. It includes code. And when a manufacturer puts encryption or some kind of software handshake between you and the code in your product, then that can often be considered a technological measure where if you circumvent that, you might be liable under this part of the DMCA. The issue has been compounded by the fact that a majority of the courts that have looked at that circumvention liability have determined that you don't get the traditional defenses that a copyright defendant has. Now, copyright law has a lot of doctrines, has several doctrines that are there to preserve rights of free speech. So I can make a parody video. I can remix that DVD into some transformative fan work to tell my own story. I can reverse engineer code to understand how it works to make competing products or products that interface with it. Now, I'm sort of telegraphing that if you don't have the ability to circumvent in order to reverse engineer, that right winds up being a lot broader than copyright traditionally has been. So if I just say if there's no access control and I reverse engineer some code, I go to the court, say it's fair use. They say, yep, it sure is. We have cases on that. But if I have to circumvent encryption to do the exact same thing, the majority of courts will say, you don't get fair use defenses to the DMCA. This is why the DMCA is a particularly difficult problem and a particularly strong hammer for manufacturers that are trying to suppress competition. So we at EFF took advantage of the fact that once every 3 years, it's possible for the public to ask for exemptions to be made to this part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So we brief the issue before the Copyright Office. It's a multi-month process, and we say that there ought to be exemptions to this form of liability. We're not saying that people are liable if they do it now, But we're saying that you should create an exemption so that it's crystal clear that if I take my car to my mechanic and they need to modify the software to fix it, they have the right to do that. If I'm an independent security researcher and I want to figure out where all the holes are in this car and how someone might remotely take it over, or even if there's just a safety issue in the braking software, you should be allowed to do that without copyright law getting in the way. And people who make aftermarket products for diagnosis or just to give you cool information about how your car is doing so you can keep it in better repair. These are all really legitimate things that people ought to be able to do. And we have 100 years of people tinkering with their cars and inventing rear view mirrors and airbags and catalytic converters and all sorts of great stuff that comes from people being able to take apart and improve on their products. So we initiated that last November. And all the briefing, all the public comments are done, and we're expecting a ruling on that in October. So we'll have some more news on the state of the legality of vehicle hacking at that point. But some of the arguments that the automakers brought up are exactly what TJ said. So as part of getting this kind of exemption, we have to establish that what we're talking about isn't an infringement of copyright. So it's not an infringement of copyright to diagnose a problem with your car. Seems pretty straightforward. Not an infringement of copyright to repair your car. But one of the legal doctrines that protects those rights, it turns on whether you are the owner of that copy. So the automakers came in and said, no, you don't actually own those copies of the software. And TJ mentioned that there can be restrictive license agreements that say you don't own it, you can't resell it, you can't reverse engineer it, et cetera. And in some cases, those license agreements have been upheld by the courts. It turns out most of the computers in your car, there's no written license agreement. And they were still so bold as to say, well, the default assumption is when you buy something that you only have a license to it, that you don't own it. Really. Uh-uh. And I don't think the Copyright Office is going to buy that either, because it's silly and it's not the law. But that is something that they've argued that got a lot of press, especially John Deere sent a letter to all the owners of tractors telling them they don't really own it. And I think there was enough public pressure to get John Deere to back down, but General Motors was happy to come in and make similar arguments. Both.
Well, John Deere's argument was, you're going to use my tractor to illegally infringe music.
That was fabulous. When I read that, I jumped out into the hall and yelled bingo, because I couldn't imagine that someone would be so silly as to say that you're going to pirate music by hacking your car in order to turn it into a general purpose computer to copy music or something.
If only I had a way to copy this, like a combine. The interesting thing is, and I hate to kind of be the voice of the car, but we have the EFF here, so I feel like I've got to make the car manufacturer arguments, even though I tend to agree with him. The other thing the car manufacturers have come up with, though, and this one carries some weight. Again, I think the Copyright Office is going to come down on the right side on this one, if for no other reason than the arguments against it are a little bit silly, and the rulings recently that you can jailbreak your iPhone kind of tie right into this same argument, and I hope they'll take that same tack. But one of the arguments the car manufacturers has taken is that it's a safety issue, that we can't let people tinker with these things because they could then endanger themselves if you turn the brakes off on your car or plug your accelerator in wrong or do something that could create a hazard. And more importantly, it would violate EPA regulations and other governmental regulations that we have to put on these cars. We have the exhaust set up in such a way that it meets the current requirements. We have the speed limited to the appropriate limits. We have the X, Y, and Z set to meet the appropriate governmental standards. The problem with that argument is that people have screwed with their car since the dawn of time. And if you don't really know what you're doing, it's pretty easy to cut the brake line and leave yourself with no brakes too. You don't need to turn off the computer wrong in order to leave yourself with no brakes. The idea that we need to protect it from an environmental perspective, well, back in the 70s, guys were hacksawing the catalytic converter off their car too. It's completely illegal. It completely violates every regulation. If you go to get your car tested, you're going to fail. But people were doing that, and there's really no difference between a hacksaw and a keyboard when it comes to changing your exhaust. So I think those arguments, again, don't really hold water in light of reality. But those are the ones, the arguments that are being made that aren't quite so specious as music pirating and licensing.
But wouldn't it be as simple for the vehicle manufacturer to simply say, our base code passed all these things. It's you've modified it, therefore we're no longer liable because you've changed this.
Well, I think it would be. I mean, honestly, I think if you did something like the guy who hacks out a catalytic converter off, his car's going to fail. It can't be sold. There's other problems with it. He's voided his warranty. There's all kinds of things they can argue about it to limit people from doing things they don't understand.
But anyway,
they're just trying to.
That's what I'm saying. Doesn't it make their whole claim pretty much spurious?
Mm-hmm.
Because it'd be like, well, you can't hold us liable anyway because we can show that you changed it from the default.
Yeah.
Turn software back to code. Audi, people ship those things all the time. You can turn it right back to what it is in the factory, and it's virtually impossible for them to know.
Right. Well,
you can. In code.
They can cut off access to proprietary software. They can cut off access to records.
Well, and GM makes a better target than, say, Joe Schmo, who just upgraded his car. So they're going to go after the guy who's got the bigger pockets.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that we've pointed out is that copyright law is not actually the law that protects the environment or protects people from vehicle safety or keeps your car from being stolen. And there are actually expert agencies that deal with highway safety and deal with the environment. And they figure out what kind of conduct ought to be legal, what the penalties should be, and so on. And here, copyright law has sort of stumbled into this field and said the whole range of everything that you can do is potentially unlawful. And it's certainly not the kind of nuanced determination that an expert agency could make. And it really is just an unintended consequence of this copyright law. And the Copyright Office, honestly, is not equipped to answer these questions for all of the 27 different exemption requests. Like, they cannot become experts at computer security. They cannot become experts at highway safety, at environmental issues. And their job is to determine whether this is an act that should be exempted from copyright liability. So if they grant this exemption, it's not suddenly legal to hack into someone's car and steal it. It's not suddenly legal to violate emission standards or what have you. This is just a question of whether these acts are infringing of copyright or not, and they're not.
So as a malicious hacker, what you mean is in favor for all intents and purposes.
So,
okay, Copyright Office, remove all restrictions. Anyone can modify their code. As a hacker, as a malicious hacker, not one that wants to modify my code.
Yeah, we need to get
you. We need to go on the mic.
Yeah. We have one person here, and then we can
got
one person there.
Well,
thank you. The automotive manufacturers don't have the legal authority to enforce the Environmental Protection Act or the Federal Motor Safety Standards. Those are required to be enforced by the specific agencies that the laws are written for. The state are enforced by the state EPAs and EPA, and I'm not sure what they call it here in Georgia. There's different acronyms depending on the state. And oh, awesome. And the feds have to enforce the federal standards. Automotive manufacturers are required to meet those standards. We aren't. Just state one question. They're trying to use the reasoning that they are leasing us the software, so we can't change it. We can't also sell it. That begs the question, if I buy a vehicle from them, can I resell the vehicle, or do I have to take it to them for a trade-in?
Do you want to field that?
Well, that's a really good question. They take that argument to its logical conclusion, yes. But I think that would really cause an uproar. Really, here's the thing. The more uproar you guys cause, the less trouble this stuff causes. So the problem is you've got to get to a point where people are pissed off enough to go yell at somebody, preferably a government official. And you should all be that pissed off all the time because government officials deserve it. But the problem with that is that, you know, you can easily get around that by saying, oh, it's a transferable license. It's still a license, but it's really not a very good argument because there is no license. You didn't sign anything. Licenses have to be agreed to in, you know, some kind of known terms. And you may not have read the crap you clicked through to get to whatever website or apply whatever software or download that app, but it's there. You could have. You clicked something. There, you didn't do anything when you bought your car to say, I'm going to accept this chip under these conditions. You don't have a right to say, I don't want that chip under these conditions. Give me the car without it. So I don't think that argument's going to fly very far. But if it did, and taken to its logical conclusion, yes.
And even if they did write in, they tried to craft some sort of transferable license that's ownership except in name, except that they reserve some rights. Whether you can resell it is one of the factors that courts look at in determining whether you own it or not. Whether it's called a license or not, a court is going to look carefully at the surrounding circumstances to figure out if you count as an owner or a mere licensee. And that's one of the factors, and I imagine there would be even more uproar if automakers tried to restrain the ability to resell cars.
Hmm. Actually, one thing I wanted to add to that point is going back to the point of fundamental ownership and the entire kind of buyer presence that if it's your choice, you're buying a car for 50 or 75 years, that you know you could take it to an auction then, or it'll be something with antique plates at the car show from now, which fundamentally, in many cases, you could look at within 15 years will be completely impossible. If you lose the master computer in that car, or even the backup control sensor or something, and then the brakes won't release when you put it in reverse, and then they say, those parts don't exist anymore. Okay, well, on an older car, you would go and you could replace all the brakes. Many people now take 50s cars and put modern disc brakes in them. They're better than they were when they came from the factory. You essentially just have a dead vehicle that can't move because the other two-thirds of the car refuse to operate. And they're, if you can't look the code, if you can't have a third party who wants to get in the business of making that work, you no longer own a vehicle.
Well, look at that idea. You can go buy, you can go buy every part from a 60s Volkswagen from a catalog. You can buy remanufactured parts for a 57 Chevy from 100 people besides Chevy. There are lots of people making those replacement parts. No one's going to be able to make the replacement codes because if it's under copyright, copyright lasts for basically ever. And you know, you're never going to get past that.
And you also run into the problem that, say, with Windows, when they sunset software, you know, people are expecting to replace their computers every couple of years, and so they can get the latest software. You don't enter a problem with a car because you can't do that. For the same reasons you're saying, it's not something you can just replace because the modern system simply won't be backward compatible. Although that may open up a whole third party market, is you know someone just making those systems compatible backwards. But again, that won't be the companies doing it. So, and I don't think that the technology is old enough yet for that to have come up, because I do think that's going to be a major issue in 10, 15, 20 years.
And if you're not allowed to reverse engineer it, then as a commercial entity, certainly
right.
The hacker community will figure some things out, but as a commercial entity.
No right.
I have a little bit different side of the same maybe question that the gentleman was raising before. I think we all believe in user freedoms, and those are great. Should we have more manufacturer restrictions? I guess what I'm saying is, are cars too easy to hack today? Should the government step in and start putting requirements for DMZs, signed code, firewalls, other things to prevent what we've seen with Jeep and some other products where there's really troubling security vulnerabilities? Thank you.
You're never going to get me to answer that the government should put more restrictions on anything.
And plus, which also goes back to who's making the most noise. And the car companies have a whole lot, or their lobbyists are way louder than most people's lobbyists are.
Okay.
And politicians will be listening to them. And obviously anything that restricts the car companies makes their life more difficult. So they're going to be pushing for as few restrictions as possible. And they're the ones who have got deeper pockets than most people do. So typically they're the ones who are going to get the biggest ear of various politicians to get that legislation passed. So it's a good idea, but it will never happen because there's no practical way of actually doing it.
So I'm going to describe a little bit of the history of independent security research in the automobile space. So a couple of researchers named Chris Miller and Charlie Valasek, as well as some teams based at University of Washington, UC Davis, started 2011-2012 taking a look at how hackable cars were. And found that almost every model they looked at, it was really easy to, the first paper was to do it from the little plug under the dashboard. Okay. Second was, now you can do it through the wireless interfaces that the car has. So it's got a Bluetooth interface. Okay, I can hack in, I can get control of the brakes, the steering, everything. So this recent GPAC over the internet is the sort of logical extension of when you connect an insecure vehicle to the internet, it's going to be hackable from the internet. But in response to the publication of that independent security research, Senator Markey got involved and sent some pointed questions to the auto manufacturers. The National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration started a cybersecurity task force. And so because people were able to arguably circumvent DRM that might expose them to DMCA liability, and because they weren't doing that, they didn't have permission from the car companies, so they weren't subject to the confidentiality agreements that they impose, they were able to go to the press, they were able to go to the public, they were able to go to Senator Markey, and as a result, auto security is in the headlines and it's been improving. As hard as that is to believe because of how insecure these systems still are, independent security research is the tool that we have to put pressure on manufacturers to fix vulnerabilities, not merely deny them, because their response to the papers was, even when it was known in the industry that wireless attacks were possible, they said, you need physical access, we're not going to worry about it. Which, if Charlie and Chris had been subject to a non-disclosure agreement and not able to put public pressure on them, we would all be less safe today. So one of the exemptions that we're asking for is specifically about enabling security and safety research. The other one is this general sort of modification one. And I think the result will be that security will be improved, because trying to do security by obscurity, by keeping everything secret, doesn't work. That leaves us vulnerable.
And that sort of goes to your question too, whether it goes to government restrictions or just public policy type, you know, public outcry to get car manufacturers to make the change. What the car manufacturers are trying to do is limit our ability to find out these problems. They're limiting our ability to test for these things. They're limiting our ability to access that code to begin with, which means I don't have to change anything because you don't know there's a problem. And that's where we're lacking that oversight. The idea of additional government oversight or restrictions, no one's going to do it because no one knows there's an issue until you show that there's an issue.
And also the exemption we're asking for is for working on your own car. So hacking someone else's car isn't even covered. And the other way this impacts security research is that people who care about being able to publish and protect people are more deterred by these laws than people are actually trying to maliciously hack.
That's what pretty much exactly what I was going to say, is that laws don't stop people from doing things. Laws give someone the ability to do something after the fact. So pretty much every law, it only stops the people who would listen to the laws anyway. So your criminal organizations who are not intending to pay attention to the law really don't care. They're definitely still involved with major crime. Fortunately, we haven't got to the point yet quite of nation state based attacks yet, but it was with 2011 that they first found that, and they issued those things when last month? They jeeping out the fobs?
Yeah, the Jeep stuff is not something they discovered in 2011, but yeah, that paper was just last month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's taking the same people 4 years to get the manufacturing company to actually do something about it. And part of why that they had to pay attention to it this time was that they actually had a volunteer who was driving one of the Jeeps, and they shut his car down doing 70 miles an hour on the highway. It was all planned. But it started off where they're just playing with the air conditioning, playing with their seats and whatnot, and they started playing with his radio, and they just killed his accelerator. So, and then later on, they were doing it at a slower speed, and they actually killed his brakes as well. And they actually got pictures of where he pretty much just coasted off into a ditch on the side of the road. And once they presented that, I think it was a DEF CON that they presented that stuff. At that point, no one could really say anything about it. They did start their presentation by saying these manufacturers need to stop saying that their cars are unhackable. And that was specifically, in that case, was actually aimed at a Daimler Chrysler executive who had said our stuff's unhackable. And a few months later, it got hacked. And I think that's a major problem there, is that they don't realize just how big of a taunt they throw out to the community, whether it be white hats or black hats or gray hats. If you say something's unhackable, people are going to say, I'm going to go find something wrong with that.
We need the cube.
I think that the one of the points that car manufacturers might miss here is the computer is not the car. The computer is part of what makes the car work. You know, it's a maybe a large percentage, but certainly just a percentage of what you pay for. So what's to keep me from taking out the original and putting in a replacement that allows me to take it? I don't think there's anything in the law that prevents that even now.
Well, again, they'd say that there is, because what you're doing is you're accessing the, you're circumventing the copyrighted software that they put in for EPA.
Not if I just take it out.
Yep.
Yep, you took it out.
That's circumventing it.
Replacing it. Circumvented as you could get.
Okay.
No, I disagree
with
that.
How about if I accidentally put my screwdriver across the terminals?
Look, I don't know that.
And need a replacement.
I don't know that argument would fly, but that's what you'd hear, is that you circumvented the software by removing the software itself. You take it out, you put a new chip in. I don't know how that would come down.
That's actually the workaround. When BMW switched to encryption that's strong enough to actually cause you to spend some money to crack it, one of the aftermarket companies, and I forget their name, said, well, it's no longer feasible to crack the encryption and reverse engineer it, which they were doing abroad. So we're just going to create replacement computers. And to my mind, it would be frivolous for the manufacturers to say that if you are removing a computer and throwing it out, that somehow you're circumventing an access control on access to that copyrighted work, because you're not accessing that copyrighted work. There could be scenarios, maybe, where you remove a component that it is an access control to something else, where maybe an argument could come into play. But that's the approach that has been taken. Unfortunately, that leads to waste, as you have these computers that no one can do anything with. It's really not a great solution, but it is a workaround that some people have been using.
So I have a question. What about them putting DRM on software that's not their copyright, like open source software that may have been licensed under a license? They don't have to publish the source code, but it's still open source to begin with. They can't. Can they legally hide that from people who can reasonably see that code by just checking out the Git repo?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question, because what you're asking is, would they ever actually be able to enforce a copyright? In order for me to sue on a copyright claim and succeed on that copyright claim, I then have to prove that I do own the copyright.
No, but I think this answers the question. What if, could you find them liable for putting DRM on code that they weren't allowed to put DRM in the first place?
So the way they actually do incorporate open source code into things that get DRM'd, and so to sort of give some context, a lot of the software community will put open source licenses on code. And so what that means is that I've written some code, but I want to grant everyone a license to reuse that code to incorporate it into their own projects. And many of those licenses, some of them are just go to town, have fun. Others include a share-alike or copyleft provision, where if you take advantage of this and you work my code into something that you're doing, you have to share that whole project back with the community. And so the question is, how can automakers take open source software, build it into something, and then lock it down so you can't see it? Don't they have to share the software? And the answer is that they do have to share the software, and the way they will typically do it is they'll have a web page somewhere on their website that says, yeah, ask us and we'll mail you a DVD of just like as little as we can justify being touched by the open source software. So they see that as a legally defensible way to conform to the open source licenses.
But
it hasn't been tested.
I haven't been there yet.
It hasn't been tested.
I'm wondering, does anybody foresee if perhaps the automakers win their control of the software, if they're going SaaS with it, to where you're going to have to pay a monthly fee to the automotive makers to keep your car running?
That's terrifying.
It is, but it is possible. I mean, look at Adobe. There is no more hard Adobe. It's all cloud.
So we'll have your car in the cloud.
Yeah. I mean, is that something that would be foreseeable?
That you subscribe to?
There can be freemium cars where you're going to have to pay if you want to get extra.
Actually, I could I could see them doing that on, for example, on like leases. They could say, all right, we're throwing in an extra $30 a month for because you're leasing the software on a car lease. I don't know if they could do it with actual car sales, but I could see them fairly easily tacking that onto a leasing condition.
Yeah, actually, something like that has been deployed, and they're called starter interrupters. So basically, you get, typically it's the financer of your auto purchase. So you buy a car, you own it, but the person who gives you the loan wants to make sure they can repossess it if you stop paying, and they don't want to deal with like due process or courts because that's like pretty retro. So they put in what's called a starter interrupter, where if they decide that you're in default, they keep your car from starting. And there was a great New York Times article talking about some of the, like, a woman who was trying to flee abuse with her child who couldn't leave the three-county area that the finance company let her be in. Someone else whose car was stopped while they were on the road. And those are sort of edge cases, but the thing that's not an edge case is that it's giving the vendor or the lender the power to take that property from you without going through a court, which is normally what has to happen if someone wants to foreclose on something.
There is actually one case, I'm just see if I got my notes over here, where a disgruntled employee from one of those companies bricked, like, I think like 100 cars to basically get back at his company. So again, it comes back down to your human's always your weakest link, because even if the technology itself is absolutely flawless, as we can see, a disgruntled employee can get in there and basically brick half your fleet.
I think there was an employee of the dealer, not the car company itself.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the car companies use the starter interrupters, do they? That's always a third party.
Okay. Two comments. Jeff, I believe you said something about cars aren't getting old enough and to where you'll have software that can't be worked with. OBD1 vehicles are already there. 95 to 2000 Ford Power Stroke diesel engines, they're already to the point to where you can't interface with the injector driver module or the courtesy module inside the vehicle, and neither will the dealer.
But has the software itself been sunsetted?
Explain that term to me, sorry.
Basically, it means that the folk who wrote the software stopped supporting it.
Ford, if you take it to Ford, they'll tell you to go buy one from a junkyard. Go buy a physical unit. They won't modify it. If you bring them a unit that has come from a junk unit or come from a similar model, and the firmware is slightly different, as it tends to be from cars made 15 minutes apart from each other, because they use something from one production run or one type of sensor or another type of water pump or something. And you need the software flash, they'll say, we no longer touch it. And then if you go and you get something done third party from some tuning company, and then you bring it back to the dealer for something that they can do, and they can do, yet still do, they'll say, we can't guarantee that any of this is going to work with your aftermarket equipment, so we're not going to touch your vehicle. Even though we wouldn't work with that equipment that you had to circumvent in the first place. So although it doesn't fall into this legal issue, we are finding vehicles that are still valid and running. I mean, it's not a collector's item. The thing will do a million miles. And there's cars, there's trucks still on the road that have done it. And they're starting to fall into that. And there is hardware. Somebody was saying something about replace the computer with something else. It's not a car, but certain CNC machines have three wire instead of two wire speed sensors and stuff. And that third wire connects to an IC in there that's one time, one way writable, that will write some hash from the computer, and only they can change the ID number of that computer. And if it ever interfaces with another main computer and the hash doesn't match, it will physically lock down a relay inside of there that makes your sensors, that if you add all of them up, they're two or three times the cost of that main computer. So it would actually blow out hardware in there if you try to physically remove and replace. So not only do you not own your software at that point, they're telling you they have the right to blow your hardware up. Oh, and there is protected hardware also. 4-liter V6s that were used in Mustangs and Explorers, late 90s, early 2000s. They have 7-sided head bolts with a safety dent in the middle. And you can't buy the socket from anybody besides Ford for something like $250.
Mm-hmm. Dang. He had a question.
We've got someone back here.
Oh, no, he's been waiting for ages.
Yeah, we've got someone who's waiting for ages.
Okay, fair enough.
Ages-er. It's a word now.
With regards to the court and a bit of paradoxical irony, talking about copyrighted software, haven't courts recently ruled, though, that you cannot even copyright software? You can maybe copyright algorithms, is it, but not the software itself?
So software can be covered by copyrights. It can also be covered by patents. So the rules for each are different, but copyright is basically the law that that governs creative work. So as soon as you write down or draw something creative, copyright can attach to it. And in the software context, generally courts think that software is pretty creative. If it gets really minimal, then they'll say that's not, that was the only way to do that, or you did it in a really conventional way, that's not copyrightable. But the law has been more dynamic around what elements of software are patentable. So patents, you have to go and apply at the patent office to get coverage. It's not a terribly rigorous process because a lot of junk gets through, but the Supreme Court has recently narrowed the scope of patentable software subject matter.
Anyway, again, the idea of copyright is it protects that particular expression of the work. You can't protect the idea, so the idea of, you know, the idea of a car computer or a word processor or whatever other software you might have, I can go make a new one. I can go make a different word processor. But you protect the software. You don't protect the idea of the software. You protect the content of the software, but what if I write it in a different manner? What if I write it in a different way? Independent creation is allowed. Where it becomes a derivative work, where it becomes new work, is a very gray area, but it is, software is something that is very easy to reverse engineer, unlike some other, you know, you can't really say, I painted that exact picture coincidentally, and I rewrote the exact book coincidentally, but I might create a software that's not copyright infringing of his software. It's a movable area in terms of derivative work, but it is something where it is a limited protection to some extent. So that might be what you're getting as well.
Go ahead.
I was just kind of wondering if car companies have started listing when they're going to start sunsetting the programs and software in their computer.
I've not seen anything like that yet, which is why I was mentioning.
It's unsustainable to, you know, go, well, I bought this, you know, 50 years ago.
Right.
Are you still going to do updates?
Right. And that's what I was actually saying, where I don't think it's become a major issue yet. And he pointed out that it is actually starting to become an issue now. Because, yeah, that is a big thing. No software company is going to maintain all its software forever. And actually, I think that it's the car manufacturer wound up taking a page from the software companies as far as, like, you know, how far back they're going to maintain their stuff. But that's going to then throw them into the loop, because most folks upgrade their computers piecemeal in ways that you just can't upgrade a car that way. So that is going to cause a major riff at some point there, once that starts ballooning up.
Okay. Hypothetically, with what you were talking about earlier with regards to somebody mentioned something about going to a monthly plan, kind of like with Adobe Suite, where you pay monthly for the access to the car. Couldn't the car manufacturers in said case say it's going to be an exorbitant transfer fee or refuse to transfer the license to another individual, making the car unsellable at that point?
Well, that just goes back to the earlier question about you can't transfer a period, so you've got to come back and sell it to me, the dealer. I just think none of those would fly, and if they tried to impose them, we'd all be driving Vespas, because you're just not going to get people to buy into that. Well, I don't know. People buy into all kinds of stupid shit. But, you know, it seems like the kind of thing that we wouldn't stand for. So,
speaking of that, would you guys consider cars to be members of the IoT class?
Yeah.
IoT's Internet of Things.
The Internet of Things is basically the universe of devices that are connected to the internet but are not something you traditionally think of as like a general purpose computer. So your internet-enabled refrigerator or your home automation system or your toaster that like can stream video of your toast to the internet. These are all Internet of Things type things. And I do think of cars as an example of that universe of objects, just because they are things that we traditionally think of as appliances that are all of a sudden connected to the internet.
Now, how do you think case law there will start affecting other things? For example, can you sell your car is one thing, but can you sell your dishwasher? Can you sell your sewing machine? Can you sell your tumble dryer?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the problem is we've decided that we want to hook everything to the internet because our fridge needs to send us a grocery list, and our toaster needs to stream our toast, and our, you know, for whatever reason, our microwave needs Bluetooth, and it's just all out there. You put all the technology in, and you've got to deal with all the technology issues, and that's more than just, oh, now the internet doesn't work and so my fridge is shut down. It's you've got to deal with these legal issues that come around it too. And these are the kinds of things, frankly, this is what created the DMCA in the first place. The idea that we had copyright law that covered things like software, because we knew enough to know that software was a thing in the 70s, but we didn't know that somebody was going to shoehorn it into their fridge. And so that's where we got the DMCA, was, holy crap, this internet thing is kind of a big deal. We need to do something to cover it under our really old Copyright Act. How do we do that? And it turns out we can do it very well. And so we keep redoing it every 3 years. And we probably still aren't doing it very well. But the more we create these things that need to be addressed, the more we're going to need to address them, and probably the worse we're going to get at it.
I'm hopeful that cars are a good early place to have this kind of legal mm-hmm. battle, because people have been hacking their cars for 100 years, and we know it doesn't make the sky fall. It, in fact, gives us really valuable innovations. It enables aftermarket. It teaches you self-reliance and all that stuff in a way that we don't quite have a long history of attachment to hacking our toasters. I mean, maybe we do, but like our home automation systems are so awesome new that toasters. We're forming new new expectations around it. So cars, because of the history, are just really relatable. And I think if the Copyright Office does the wrong thing in October, I'm hoping that you'll all join us in some outrage over the way that Section 1201's anti-circumvention provisions are being over-applied.
Yeah, in fact, I think this is the best way to do it, because unfortunately, if we'd gone the other way, and people were talking about their fridges and their toasters, I think copyright would be a lot more restrictive, and we'd end up with it over these things that we really ought to be able to make modifications to. So starting with something that everyone understands the importance of access to, and the importance of having a mechanic have access to, and the shade tree mechanic having access to, versus, oh, some poor bastard can't get his grocery list from his fridge, we're going the right way with this one. So hopefully the law will come out the right way.
Talking about government intervention, I think having the government write rules would be the worst possible thing. They'd do a horrible job, and then we'd be stuck with them for 15 years before they get updated. But I think it seems like simply saying that if a car manufacturer has their car hacked and somebody is injured from it, that they're liable for that, that ought to be sufficient, right?
Well, it also depends who becomes liable for it, because a lot of those programs are sourced out to other companies. So, let's say it's VW. Does that make VW responsible? Does it make the people that VW bought the software or licensed software from? Are they liable for it? If their interaction happened because there was a conflict between two pieces of software, is the third party responsible for it?
Well, I would think if I bought the car from VW. VW is the one who's responsible for it, and it's up to them to take care of it.
And VW doesn't want that, so they fight that very, very hard, because they're like, we just provide the software that these guys gave us.
And the courts will assign a sort of different level of responsibility to the manufacturer if the harm to you was caused by someone else's intentional conduct against you. So someone else is hacking your car to hurt you, then the manufacturer is going to be much less responsible than if when they released it from the assembly line, it was dangerous to you.
Yeah, this is very different than a product's liability issue. If VW releases a car that after 90 days the chip freezes up and your car plows into trees, they're going to be really, really, really liable for a whole lot of things. But if VW releases a car that someone hacks and drives you into a tree, like they did the Jeep, what do you do with that? Who's going to be responsible there? And it's not as clear cut. It's not a product's liability case at that point. It's an intentional act. And we could go on for three more panels about how that would break down in the courts. But
if they know that there's a fault with it, like you say, security through obscurity, wouldn't that then put them right back into the seat of, well, it's like a, for example, like a bad chip that froze up? Because it's a problem we knew about,
right?
We just never fixed it.
That's where we get into the other three panels worth of product liability stuff. Come back tomorrow.
How will how will intellectual property rights affect the ability of manufacturers to create the same security standards or accommodate the same security standards?
The same as what?
The same as what? The same standards as what other standard?
So with intellectual property rights, I mean, different companies will have to accommodate other patents from other or copyrights or other patents from other companies.
Right.
So how would they be able to do that and maintain the same security standards?
They license that out. They've all got huge, complicated contracts between each other as to exactly who gets what out of this. Like, are we buying the software, releasing the software? Who updates it? For example, like, if there is an update, does it go back to the original company? Or does, say, VW take over? Does it hire engineers who are going to keep that software updated? That's very much between the companies involved.
So when discussing the internal components of the car system, the one thing that the manufacturer doesn't want to do is they don't want to have segmented systems. So they want to have one system instead of multiple ones. That way they don't have to do what you're talking about, and that's have one system that handles security, another that handle or security and life safety, another one that will handle the multimedia feature. Because then they're having different security levels between the hooks that go to each other. But one thing that's also really important that I think we need to address is the licensing issue. I don't know if anybody has ever sat down and read their user agreement with Microsoft, 1,800 pages, okay? When you buy a car, you actually have agreed that you've read the licensing agreement for the operation of that vehicle. It is not in the user manual that's in your glove box, but there is a link to go find it and read it. By turning the car on once, you've agreed with everything that's in that license agreement. So this is something that I think, you know, you guys are making public. We need to educate. We really need to educate the market to look at their user agreements instead of just clicking through the yes, 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 yes.
Well, good luck with that. I've been saying that for 10 years.
Yeah, well, there was a study done that if you read all of the click wrap agreements that you're agreeing to each year, it takes you a month of your year. So it's an unrealistic way. It's unrealistic to think that letting corporations who are going to repeat this transaction with a bunch of individuals have their lawyers write the most abusive thing that they can to protect themselves and take away your rights, and then courts are going to take that seriously and enforce it. We are very close to that actually being the reality. Now, that's not the reality, because just because they say you agreed by turning that key, if it's buried in the back of the manual and there's a link somewhere and no one called your attention to it, a court is unlikely to actually find that you agreed to that contract. And that's true also of some browse wrap agreements as well. Mm-hmm. There's a spectrum between that you sign it in blood or they hit it at the back of some manual and it's most likely not going to be enforced. But also, one of the things that we are working on is looking at the substance of those agreements. So when you had an agreement that wasn't negotiated, that was just imposed on you, it was take it or leave it by someone with sophisticated lawyers, and it's in a context where it's one of these agreements that they know you're not going to read. We need to pressure the courts, and the states are also working on this, to pull back on what they're able to impose on their customers through those agreements, because they're just terms of abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, right now, as long as you make a knowing click, most courts are going to uphold a lot of those things. And the reality is, you can just look at every quarter there's some hubbub about what Facebook changed and where they put your stuff and what they released of your private information this time. Well, Google reads your mail. Every time you sign up for some free service, every time you say, oh, this is neat and handy, you look at the app you download next time. Why does it need access to your phone? Why does it need access to your pictures? Why does it need I don't know, but it's free and I get to shoot zombies, so it's great. Well, that's stupid. But I mean, the problem is that we all do it because we all want to get the cool shiny thing and the free thing, and we agree to all kinds of terrible crap. And that's what I said earlier. I really hope that this is going to cause public uproar, but we have agreed to so much stupid shit already because we get the free shiny thing.
Think of it this way. If you are not paying money for a service, you are the payment. Mm-hmm. Because basically they're selling something that they're getting from you in exchange for using their service. And that's actually a very strong argument for pushing companies to make a pay service, because you've got a lot more control over it if you're actually paying money out for it. But you tend to lose a lot of your argument if it's, well, it's free, don't use it.
From a personal security point of view, do either of you see yourselves buying a new car anytime soon?
Not a Jeep.
My cars don't connect to anything.
Yeah, no, I personally, I would definitely be looking for something that is not particularly complicated. Partially for that, but partially just because the more complicated it is, the more things it can break. Mm. And typically, your car prices are high enough for the actual physical components, they're way higher for the components you can actually get to. They can be much, much more expensive to replace. And then I've got a problem with introducing that many breakpoints into what in many ways is still a fledgling technology, and which the manufacturers are simply not willing to take responsibility for yet, because they have not been forced to take responsibility yet for it. Which means something goes wrong, it's pretty much me against the, whoever the car manufacturer is. And while their lawyers won't tell you, that you'll get very nasty letters from their lawyers saying everything you've agreed to, and it'll be up to you to take them to court to go fight that, and it's gonna cost you a lot more money than it's gonna cost them to do that.
I kick myself for parting with my 1990 Volvo station wagon. I thought 250,000 miles was a lot at the time.
In reference to liability on, software issues with electronic cars, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure in the past year or 2 years, there was a woman who drove a Ford who had some kind of buffer overflow in her accelerator and it caused her to smash into something. Does anybody know what the outcome of that case was? Because I remember very specifically, she had some kind of overflow in her accelerator and caused her to drive into something. I don't remember what it was, and I don't remember the exact case.
I think it was a Toyota. It was Prius. Yeah. Prius or Camry, I think. Mm-hmm.
The outcome was that there was a recall. Toyota then released that we're not having any issues, which I'm sure was 100% accurate. The reality is that's how you're going to handle a product issue like that. If there really is a problem with the chip, if there really is a software issue, you're going to recall the product. If the problem is that there's some malicious interface with that chip, Toyota's not going to do anything about it.
Yeah, there were a number of instances of litigation around that unintended acceleration defect. The jury in Oklahoma, I think, was the one that found liability based in part on expert testimony, where the expert went in and determined that the company didn't take adequate security measures to prevent regular spikes in the function of the electronic system from corrupting the software, and that ultimately that led to the harm. So there is one court case that found that Toyota was liable for that issue.
Quick question: How many of you folk have rented a car in the last 2 years? How many of you connected your phone to the Bluetooth system within that car?
Hell no.
How many of you agreed to sync your messages and contacts with the car? How many of you cleared out that thing when you took the car back? I've rented a number of cars, and it's frightening to see how many systems are still in there. Next time you rent a car, before you pair your system, go through and see how many are still in the car. Now, this came up, I think, last year or the year before, and if I was going to hack something, I'm not going to bother with a brake system or whatnot. I'm going to go to the Ferrari dealership, I'm going to rent one of their cars, I'm going to hack that thing, and all I'm going to do is tell it to sit and just record everybody who connects to it, just record their messages, record their phones, and then in 2 months I'll go and rent the same car again and untake my stuff and walk back, and I've got everyone's messaging, everyone's phone book. And if you're dealing with a high-end car, you're probably going to be dealing with relatively powerful people. And depending on where you do it, you could probably target it for celebrities, you could target it for politicians. So be aware of the sort of things that are going around you, even when it's completely innocuous and it's not actually an open hack. You're basically making yourself vulnerable by using these features, but not using them in a way that's protecting you.
Not just using Bluetooth, but if you use the wire, just a USB connection to charge.
Right.
And it has a media port.
It can pick it up from there.
And grab all your information.
Now, fortunately, that's pretty much just Apple, though. I've not seen that with the Android devices, at least not yet.
Okay, Apple asks you whether to try the device or not.
Right.
Do what you said with the Tesla, it's already connected to the internet, you don't have to go back and re-rent it.
There you go.
I have a scenario, and I was wondering what the anticipated outcome that you would predict would be if the state vehicles, like state police, if their cars had those chips and they went kerplooey, or if they eventually fell into disrepair and were unable to keep up. What do you anticipate the state would then start doing? How would they view it? Because now they're vulnerable.
I don't think obsolescence will ever become really a problem there, because they either run their cars into the ground or they replace them fairly regularly. Now, someone hacking and breaking a state trooper's car while he's chasing you is a whole different thing. So yeah, if you're planning on doing anything really, really bad, become a hacker and make sure that the guy is chasing you has got a chip you can hack. If something like that happened, you would see it all over the front pages.
Yes.
Yeah.
One other minor thing with that, probably last time I saw, probably about 58-60% of most of the cruisers, I'm talking cruisers, not meter reader vehicles and stuff, dealt from the standards of about 3 major police organizations. So they actually do get a little different tooling and systems and stuff. They're not necessarily your production car.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible, but it's certainly going to probably take another 5 or 7 years.
Well, they do also have a whole lot more electronics in them, mm-hmm. because they've got a whole lot more uplinks. They've got computer systems that are far, like you say, far beyond the regular consumer car, which in many cases may actually make it easier to get into those cars.
Well, but it's a separate stack from the car.
It's standalone.
That's
right.
All controlled by an entirely different group of idiots.
So, please wrap up.
All right. Well, we need to go ahead and close this out. So hopefully we've answered all your questions, or at least gave you more questions to go home and think about, and get in touch with the Copyright Office before October.
Yeah, we'll have some clarity in October, so.
Good job.
So EFF.org for the latest on what happens in October.